here today for our target for today, featuring Steve Snyder, who is here to talk about his father, Howard, Lieutenant Howard Snyder, and the crew of the Susan Ruth, and how Steve himself has been researching his father's story, you know, and also tracing and walking in his father's steps, you know, through his escape and evasion in Belgium and France and that sort of thing, which I just think is fabulous that he can, you know, go to these places and, you know, there's still, of course, people who remember and that sort of thing. So welcome, everyone. I'm Heather here, the Director of Education, and thank you for joining us today. And thank you, Steve, for coming to the museum again. I'm wearing my 306 Bomb Group shirt today in honor of your father and his crew. So thank you.
Thank you, Heather. Well, I'm delighted to be back at the museum again to make a new presentation. I love the Mighty Eighth Museum. As Heather mentioned, my book Shot Down, The True Story of Pilot Howard Snyder and the Crew of the B-17 Susan Ruth. The first part of the book builds up to the day that the plane was shot down, and then the second half of the book is all about what happened afterwards. And I'm so blessed and so fortunate to know so much about what happened to my dad and each member of his crew. And not only that, but to know so much about many of the Belgian people that were involved in their stories, and really more significantly, so many of the locations where the events took place that are still there today that you can visit and see where history took place. This is my dad's crew. My dad is in the lower left. He was the first pilot, Howard Snyder, and then going across, you have the co-pilot, George Eich, the navigator, Robert Benninger, the bombardier, Richard Daniels, and then the six enlisted men above, which is Kyle Roy Holbert, the flight engineer, Lewis Colwert, the ball turret gunner, Ross Kaler, radio operator, John Pindrock, the right waist gunner, Joe Musial, the left waist gunner, and then Bill Schlenker, who was the tail gunner. It was on a mission to Frankfurt, Germany on February 8th, of 1944, where their plane was attacked by two German Focke-Wulf fighters, and it was shot down over the French-Belgium border, right at the border. The southern Belgium is very rural, farmland, sparsely populated. And it was one of the pilots of those Focke-Wulf 190s was Siegfried Merck. And you can visit his grave in Lommel, Belgium at the German War Cemetery. In the mid-80s, they dug up his plane, and parts of his plane are contained in this little museum that's in Montsou-en-Brechies, Belgium. And here you see one of the propeller blades. That's the propeller hub, the crankshaft. And the museum holds a lot of the artifacts and memorabilia about the war and what happened locally. Also, my dad's Eisenhower jackets in that little museum. The other pilot of the Focke-Wulf 190 was Hans Berger. And I was able to find Hans Berger. Fortunately for me, he became a translator after the war. So he speaks perfect English, and he gave me some wonderful insight that's in the book about what it was like to go up against the 8th Air Force. Basically, he was scared to death every time he went up to have to try to meet those bombers and those fighters. This is Hans with me at his apartment in Munich, Germany. I've been over there a couple times to visit him. He shot down seven B-17s and one Spitfire, and he was shot down three times himself. He's wearing his fighter jacket there. You probably can't see his iron cross that he has on. And interestingly enough, of all the people that are involved in the shot down story, he's the only one who's still alive. He celebrated his 98th birthday on October 9th, just a little while ago. In visiting Hans, he showed me his photo album that has some amazing pictures of his career in the Luftwaffe and gun sight photos that he has targeted on B-17s or B-24s, which are very fascinating, pretty eerie. But one thing that was really unique is he showed me his logbook, his flight log, and in there, he has his entry on February 8th, 1944, where he shot down a B-17, and then he was shot down, actually by the gunners on my dad's plane, and he had to bail out. But he made it through the war. The B-17 Susan Ruth was named after my oldest sister, who was 1 year old at the time my dad went overseas. It came down in the village of Mackinaws, which is just north of the French border, at the distillery farm, or the property of the distillery farm, and that's what the distillery farm looked like back in the day. This is what it looks like now. And then catty corner to that is a memorial that they erected to my dad and his crew in 1989. And my dad and the three other crew members that were still living at the time, whatever, for the dedication. And like most World War II veterans, my dad didn't talk a lot about the war before this, but at the dedication ceremonies, he was reunited with all these Belgian people that hit him during the war and visited these places where he was hidden, and that brought it all back, and he started talking about it. And then I made my first visit to Belgium 5 years later with my parents, and that's when it became personal for me because I saw all these places. I've been to Belgium 6 times now. Here's the memorial a little closer up. It has two plaques on the front. It has a list of the names of the crew, their ages at the time, and their crew positions on the plane. When the B-17 Susan Ruth was attacked, two of the crew were killed in the plane by the 20-millimeter cannon fire of the 190s. On the left, you see Ross Kaler, the radio operator, and then Lewis Colworth, the ball turret gunner. This picture shows their bodies lying in a field right across from the distillery farm shortly after the plane came down. Lewis Colworth is buried in the Ardennes American Cemetery, as are some other men involved in the shot down story. Three other crew members, they became prisoners of war. On the left, you see the bombardier Richard Daniels, in the middle, the flight engineer Kyle Roy Holbert, and then the left waist gunner, Joe Musial. Joe Musial had his foot almost shot off in the plane before he bailed out. He was picked up very quickly by the Germans, and as I said, they were taking him to a hospital. They came across Richard Daniels on the left, who was just wandering aimlessly along this road. Richard Daniels, he had his bicep just shot apart and was severely injured. And so they took Daniels and Musial into the Dr. Trigault's medical clinic in Chimay, Belgium, in the town square. There's a church on one end, the 500-year-old church, and then a castle on the other, where they gave medical attention to Daniels and Musial. And the medical clinic is just on the left there. After that, they took them to St. Giles Prison in Brussels, where Roy Holbert also ended up. That's what it looked like then. This is what it looks like now, not too much different. And they stayed there for a short period of time, really scared for their lives, because that was a prison, regular prison, where they kept criminals and then members of the resistance that had been arrested. And while they were there, they could hear people being tortured, people being executed. So they were worried that they were going to be executed. But they weren't. They went on to various prison camps and so forth. Because of Joe Musial's and Richard Daniels' injuries, the seriousness of those injuries, they were repatriated back to the U.S. in early 1945, before the war ended. Roy Holbert, he went to Stalag Luft 4 up in Prussia or Poland now, and he spent the remainder of the war as a POW, and he was involved in the 86-day Black March in early February. This is John Pindrock, the right race gunner. After he came down, the resistance picked him up, and they took him to the house of George and Nellie Delshorn. This is George, and this is what their farm looked like. It's kind of been built up around there now, but that was the farmhouse that he stayed in that you can visit. Two other crew members, the co-pilot George Eich and the bombardier Robert Benninger, they were picked up by the resistance and taken to the home of Esther and Valerie Fossette in Riez, Belgium. Stayed there for a short period of time, and then they moved to a resistance camp in Riez. This is what the camp looked like back then. They stayed there for a little while. There was a few other downed airmen there. There were some escapees from German prisoners of war camps. There were several men who were trying to evade being sent to Germany as slave labor. But on February 22nd of 44, that camp was raided by the Germans and everyone split and spread out. And then George and Robert, along with some other airmen, they went to this cabin in the Plumont Woods, which is right outside Chimay, Belgium. That's the largest town in the area. That's what it looked like then. This is what it looks like now. But because this location was so close to town, where there was a German garrison and a Gestapo headquarters, they thought it was too dangerous for them to stay there too long. So they moved him to a cow shed for a little bit. And then they built a hut out further out of the woods to hide. And this is what the hut looked like at the time. It was kind of subterranean. It was built into the ground, and the roof touched the ground on either side. And then it was 30 feet long, 10 feet wide. It had a bed here, and then a little table here, and then there's about 150 feet away, they built a latrine. Some local members of the resistance helped them build that. And we know all the specification to this because one of the men that was there, my name's slipping, a tail gunner on the Ration Passion 306 Ration, Warren, excuse me, I'm forgetting his name. Anyway, he described what that hut looked like. This is a path that leads to the hut. The forest rangers kind of built a little road that leads out to it now, but it says you can see deep into the woods. And this is the location of where that hut was. It's marked by those four stones that you can go visit it where it was. You can see the raised area there. These three men here work for the Forest Department. Pierre, Philippe. This is Jacques Lalot. And if it probably wasn't for Jacques or another gentleman named Paul Delahaye, I probably wouldn't have written the book. Jacques and Paul were young men during the war, or young boys, I should say, and they were greatly affected by it. They saw firsthand atrocities committed by their families and friends. Jacques saw his mother beaten right in front of him by the Nazis. And they became local historians later in life, and they interviewed all these Belgian people and members of the Belgian underground about events that took place, and they documented their testimony, and they gave me unbelievably detailed information about events that took place that would have been lost forever without their dedicated research. So I owe them a great, great debt. And then this is Olivier Perisseau. He built a 5-foot model of my dad's plane that's in that little museum that I showed you earlier. They were aided by many Belgian people. This is a Simone family. This is Florence Simone. He helped them build that hut. This is his wife, Jean, their daughter, Fernande, their son, Joseph, and then this is Jules Boulet, who was the fiancé of Fernande. And this is their farmhouse that they lived in, not too far from the hut. And Florent, they would bring them food. Jean would wash their clothes, and supply provisions. This is Jules Boulet house, which is just a short distance away. And then this is a hill of cows road, it's called, that leads up from the farmhouse into the woods where the hut was. And Florent would get on his bicycle with milk pails on either side. To take food up or clean clothes, because there's collaborators all over the place and he had to make sure that no one could see what he was actually doing. And that leads to the hut. Another person that helped them was Albert Manet. He lived along the hill of Cowles Road, and that was his farmhouse. And at the peak, there were 10 airmen that was living in that hut. Warren Cole was that man's name. I slipped my mind for a minute. There were three from my dad's crew, both George Ike and Robert Benninger, and then John Pindrock that had been staying with the Shorms. He was a young guy, only 19 years old, and he just got too nervous and too scared to stay by himself. So he joined up with them, and he was in the hut. So in the hut, there were three members of my dad's crew. There were five members of the 306 Ration Passion crew. There was Vincent Reese from the 303rd Woman's Home Companion, B-17. And then another crewman from the 91st Bomb Group. Namely, that plane was the Skunk Face. On April 22nd of 1944, the hut was raided. A Belgian collaborator told the Gestapo that these airmen were hiding out in the woods. And 1,500 men, they were units of the Gestapo, other SS police units, military police, German soldiers, came and they attacked the area. They went to various homes of people that they thought were resistance helpers, and then surrounded the hut and captured all eight men. Two of the men, Warren Cole and a buddy of his, Ivan Glaze, crew member, they decided to leave the hut. They were sitting waiting in the hut because they were waiting to get out through escape routes down through France, over the Pyrenees into Spain, and then out through British-controlled Gibraltar. But they kept having delays and delays and delays. So Cole and Glaze decided to go out off by themselves, and they actually made it back to England. But the eight men that were there were captured by the Germans, taken to this schoolhouse in Chimay. That's what it looked like back then. This is what it looks like today. And on one of my visits to Chimay, we were going to the schoolhouse, and I decided just to walk in. And the Belgian people that were with me, they were kind of going, "Well, you just can't walk into the schoolhouse, you know." But we did, and then my friend told one of the school teachers why we were there, and she took us up to a classroom, and there's still German writing in this classroom that says, "Today the German soldier and his active participation will determine the fate of Europe." I get chills just looking at that. But during the war, this was the Germans took over the schoolhouse. It was a garrison for German soldiers. And they interrogated the soldiers. They also interrogated some of the helpers. And then they took all eight men back out in the woods, and they shot them, murdered all eight of them. There's a memorial there to the eight members of the eight U.S. airmen that were murdered. Also, the names of two Belgian helpers. That was Joseph Simon on the left, Henry Fontaine, that were aiding them. They were sent to concentration camps and never heard from again. This is John Pindrock's grave, and that's John Jamborski's grave, and that's in the Netherlands American Cemetery in Margraten. So four of the men that were killed at the hut are buried in the Netherlands. And then Billy Hewish and Vincent Reese grave there as well. This is my dad's telegunner, Bill Schlenker. He came down in France, and he was taken to the farmhouse of Marie Auger. That is Marie on the right with her fiance at the time. This was taken before the war started, right before, but he was captured in 1940 when the Germans first invaded the lowlands, and he spent the remainder of the war as a POW, but he did make it through the war, and they were married afterwards. And this is Marie Auger's farmhouse. It's now owned by her granddaughter. And Bill Schlenker was taken here. He spent a couple nights here in the basement. And this is the basement that he stayed in, and that's Bill's grandson standing in front. You can see how small the basement is, Brian Schlenker. But he didn't stay there long because he had some shrapnel wounds in his foot. It was rather serious. So they took him into the Chimay, into that medical clinic. They snuck him in through the back door, and they gave medical aid to his foot, and then snuck him back out. and then took them to the home of Josephine Calais in Chimay. This is Josephine and with her two daughters, Giselle and Paula, and that's Bill. He celebrated his 20th birthday with them. And he stayed there the remainder for 7 months until the U.S. armies came up through France after D-Day to liberate the area. That's what it looked like back then. That's Paula and Giselle on the balcony there, and then this is what it looked like, looks like today. It wasn't just this house, it was a, this is part of it too. The Calais were a rather well-off family. They were merchants, and prior to the war, Josephine's husband thought that money wasn't going to be worth too much with the Germans coming in, so he spent all his money buying goods, food and things like this that would be worth something during the war as barter or trade. But the Germans came and confiscated everything he had, and he was so distraught that he hung himself and committed suicide. Down the street lived Ferdinand Delporte, aka Albert. He was head of the local resistance group in the area. And this is his home. It's just a few doors down from the Calais home. And this is now a restaurant in Chimay, but that's where the Gestapo headquarters was during the war. After my dad bailed out, he came down in these trees right at the French-Belgian border, and his parachute got hung up on the trees, and he was on the branches, and he was dangling 20 feet off the ground and couldn't get down. But fortunately for him, a couple young Belgian men, Henri Franken and Raymond Durvan, came to his rescue before the Germans got there. This picture was sent to him after the war by Henri Franken. These are the trees that came down. And a picture sent to Henri Franken. There's over 200 time period photographs in the books. You can visualize everything you're reading about. And then this is Henri Franken standing next to the tree that they helped him down. They told him to stay put because it was daylight. They thought it was too dangerous to try to move him during the day with German patrols combing the area. But that night they came back and got him, and they took him to the Durvan farmhouse. This is what it looked like back then. This is a Durvan family. This is Raymond Durvan, who helped my dad down out of the trees. This is his dad, Edmund. Edmund's wife, Ida. And then that's Raymond's sister and her husband. And this is what the house looks like today. And that house is in Belgium, and those trees are in France, so it's right at the border. He only stayed there one night because they thought it was too dangerous for him to stay there any longer than that with those German patrols in the area. So the next night, a Belgian customs officer, Paul Tilquin, came on a tandem bicycle to take him to a safer location. First, they went to the customs house in Mackinaws, which looked like that. This is what it looks like today. And then they headed out. It was the middle of the night, pitch dark, rainy. And they were riding pedaling the bicycle up a hill, and they got to a hill and they couldn't pedal it up anymore, so they started pushing it up to the hill. When they got to the top of the hill, they came to a building. This is what it looks like today. The back portion of this was not there back then. But the lights were on, music was playing, people were talking, laughing, and all of a sudden two German officers come walking out with these two young girls. One of them puts his arm around my dad and asks for a light for a cigarette. Well, my dad couldn't speak German, he couldn't speak French yet then, so he was petrified, but Paul knew what they wanted, so he lit the guy's cigarette and they let my dad and Paul go on their way. My dad said they were too drunk, or schnockered as he put it, and too interested in these young girls to pay much attention to a couple guys pushing a bike up in the middle of the night. And after that he was moved from place to place to place. How long he stayed at any given location depended on how brave the people were who lived there and how dangerous the Belgium underground thought it was for him to stay there. He might spend one night at one location or 6 weeks at another location. Initially, Paul took him to the home of Mr. Sohi, who was the bailiff of Chimay, and then he was moved quite a few miles away to Charleroi, where he stayed with numerous people. This is Charles Schulten here. That was his home. The portion on the left stayed with him for a while. This is Jack and Eva Martin. He stayed with Eva Martin and her two daughters. Her husband Jack was actually an officer in the British Army during World War I. And before they could get out of Belgium, the Germans captured them. And they arrested Mr. Martin, took him to a prisoner of war camp, and they did all these medical experiments on him. At the end of the war, he went back to England and was in hospitals for lengthy periods of time. But he had had cancer, which they thought was from all the chemicals that they injected into his body, and he died at a rather young age. This is the Martin house, which looks like today. My dad also stayed with Jeanette Godin for a lengthy period of time. That's Jeanette here, and also with Ghislaine Bayou and her husband Maurice. That's Maurice. And this is their home in Charleroi. On one of my trips back there, we were standing outside taking pictures, and the man who lives there opened up the upper window and said, "May I help you?" He could speak English, and we said, "Yeah, my dad was hidden in that house during the war, so he was quite interested in that." Came down, and I was showing him all these pictures that I had of the house and so forth, and I showed him this picture of my dad inside. And he goes, "Oh my goodness, that wall covering is still there today." So I tried to take my picture against it. I didn't do a very good job of posing the same as my dad, but amazingly enough, that wall cover is still in that house 75 years later. And then this is the backyard, which pretty much looks the same today as it did then. Here's my dad. He wore a beret quite a bit back then. They're trying to blend him in with the locals. And then this is Ghislaine Bayou. This is Mimi Gabriel. She was 16 years old. That's Mimi's mother. They live next door. And Mimi helped my dad learn French. She could speak English, so they had played cards together, a Monopoly, do crossword puzzles, and that's how he learned to speak French, conversational French. This is another couple, Albert and Amy Cools. Sent to my dad after the war. You see my dad's picture on their mantle there. And after a while, my dad got tired of hiding. He was almost discovered several times, and those they're described in the book. Word came that the Allies had landed in Normandy on June 6th, D-Day, and he decided to get back in the fight. Unlike most airmen, my dad was in the infantry in the Army for a year before he went into the Air Force, so he knew how to fight on the ground. So he decided to join the French Resistance. And his helpers tried to talk him out of it because it was so dangerous. He could die fighting against the Germans, or if they had captured him, he would have been shot on the spot as a terrorist. But he convinced Amy Cools to take him across the border in France. That was the Cools house. This is Amy and my dad that they rode bicycles across the border. First of all, though, they went back to the Franken farm where he stayed because they had to make arrangements to join the Mackie. That was the name for the French Resistance, because it's probably pretty surprising to them that some U.S. airmen would want to join the resistance that was made up of some Frenchmen, some from Belgium, and some Algerians. But he stayed in this room here. That's Henri Franken's mother and his younger brother. This is what it looks like today. And on one occasion, I went into the house, and this is the room that my dad stayed in. And just to show you how small it is, I could reach out and touch both walls. So he joined up with the French Resistance, and this is the farmhouse they stayed in Wallers, France. This picture was taken in 1994 when I went over to Belgium for the first time with my dad. That's my dad there, and he stayed in this tower, and where these two rooms are, the two little windows are. And that's the back of the farmhouse. This is a grain loft up here, and on one occasion I went up there, and you have to crawl through all this animal feed here and then go up a ladder and then up to the little room, and then there's just little tiny you know, crawl space that you can come into the room. That's me coming in the room. And then this is me, that's my son, youngest son, Clayton, and that's the owner of the farm. This is where my dad stayed. And on one occasion, he looked out that those two little windows in the front and saw a German patrol coming up the road. So he jumped out the back of the window here where I'm standing and hightailed it into the woods so he wouldn't be captured. And there are several encounters that the French resistance group had with the Germans that are described in the book. Basically, they attacked convoys, they sabotaged railroads, disrupted communication, assassinated German officers. So there's some pretty exciting and thrilling things that he was involved in there. And then 7 months after he bailed out, word came that there were U.S. troops in the nearby village of Trelon, France. So he walked into the town square, went up to an army major. Actually, it was an element of Patton's Third Army, which had come up through France after D-Day. They interrogated him. Once they were satisfied, he was legit. He hopped a ride on a convoy taking German prisoners to Paris, and then hopped on a transport to get back to England, where he sent a telegram to my mother saying, "Is that sweet little chin still up, baby? Back at base, fit as a fiddle, we'll write, bank the money, love," because he had all that back pay coming from missing an action for 7 months. And then he was sent back to the U.S. because the Air Force had a rule that if you were shot down and aided by the underground, that you couldn't go back into combat. Because they thought if you were shot down a second time and captured and tortured by the Germans, you'd give up the identity of people that helped you the first time. The only exception to that rule was Chuck Yeager, who personally met with General Eisenhower and talked him into letting him go back into combat. So my dad went back to the States and became a B-17 flight instructor for the remainder of the war, where he was reunited with my mother, Ruth. This is Susan Ruth, after his plane was named after. And then this is Nancy, my other sister, who lives in Atlanta. She was born while my dad was missing in action. So he didn't know whether he had a boy or a girl until he got back to England. My dad brought back a number of items from the war. This is his armband that he wore when he was fighting with the resistance. This is his llama pistol, a Spanish llama that he used when he was fighting with the resistance. This is a German belt that he took off a Waffen SS tank sergeant when he was fighting with the resistance. It says, "Loyalty is my duty" on the belt buckle. So my dad was one of the lucky ones. Five of his crew came home, but five of them did not. You know, five of those 26,000 men who died in the 8th Air Force. And the brave young men who fought and died for freedom, their sacrifice must never be forgotten. It's our duty to remember. Thank you very much. If anybody has any questions, I'd be glad to answer them. If anyone wants to buy a book, it's in the gift store downstairs.
So, while he was missing, your mom had a telegram that he was missing in action. Was that what happened?
Yeah, they were shot down on February 8th. On February 23rd, she received a telegram from the War Department saying that my dad and his crew were missing in action. Obviously, that was very tough on her with a one-year-old baby girl and then an infant. Well, actually, Nancy hadn't been born yet. She was born in April, a couple months later. And another thing that's really nice about the book is there's excerpts from lots of letters that the crew members wrote. My dad was really candid in what he wrote. He talked about what missions were like, what life was like on the air base, what life was like in England, London at the time, escapades of him and his crew. But the most moving letters, I think, are the ones that the loved ones wrote to each other, mothers, wives, sweethearts, after the plane was shot down and missing in action. Like writing letters trying to support one another and strengthen one another in the hope and prayer that their loved one would come back home.
You mentioned a couple of folks that were repatriated due to bad medical conditions. Did that happen very much? I hadn't heard of that before.
I don't know. I haven't researched how much it was done. The Switzerland acted as the protecting power and the intermediary between the Allies and the Axis powers. And so the Swiss Red Cross arranged for this exchange of prisoners, which was they took aboard a ship, the Gripsholm, it was called, both Richard Daniels and Joe Musial, in early February of 45 out of Marseille, to come back to the U.S. And I think I forgot to mention that when Joe Musial was taken to that medical clinic, his foot was just dangling for some tendons, so they amputated his foot. And then when he got back to the States, he went into a hospital in New Jersey where they amputated some more of his foot to clean it. And he met a nurse there and married her, and then moved to Miami and became a police officer. But Richard Daniels, with his bicep being shot out, he lost the use of that arm for the remainder of his life. And he had, talking with his family, he had, you know, serious problems with PTSD. Roy Hulbert, who spent the war as a POW, he had a thick head of black hair. And he came home, it was snow white after his experience of being in that prison.
Now, your father started out as an infantryman. Had he been, had any experience flying, or just he decided it would be better to be in the Air Corps than the
No, he didn't have any flying experience at all. As a result of the first peacetime draft in history, implemented by President Roosevelt in September of 40, he went into the Army in April of 1941. He was stationed at Fort Lewis, Washington. But then, you know, he got married and had a baby on the way, and he didn't think he could support him very well on a private's pay in the Army. So he decided to join the Air Force, where he could make more money, especially if he could make it through pilot training and become an officer. So in June of 42, he went through pre-flight training in Santa Ana, California, and went through the various pilot training stages. And then he became a pilot in Douglas, Arizona in April of 43, and then went through transitional training to learn how to fly a four-engine B-17 at Pyote, Texas, went to operational crew training in Dalhart, Texas, where the various members of the crew came together. And then when they were deemed ready, they were assigned overseas to the European Theater of Operations, and they reported to the 306 Bomb Group on October 21st of 43. So they were a replacement crew after the second Schweinfurt raid on October 14th, when they lost so many planes on Black Thursday.
How many missions had he flown before he was shot
down? He was shot down on his eighth mission. Some of the officers had more missions. My dad was the center on the basketball team, even though he was, you know, at 6'3", he played center back then. But he tore the ligaments in his ankle in one of the games, and he couldn't fly for 2 months. So some of the other officers on the crew had 11, 12 missions, but then some of the gunners on his crew only had five or six. John Pindrock, he suffered serious frostbite injuries on one mission, and he was in the hospital for 2.5 months. And then the ball turret gunner, Lewis Colwart, who was killed, he was injured on another mission, and he spent some time in the hospital. My dad and his crew only flew two missions together as a full 10-man crew, the last one and the one before it. It's interesting, on the night before the fatal mission on February 8th, my dad and the other officer of the crew, they went to the Falcon, which is still there today, and that's where I met Tim Moore. They put one on. My dad said that they had these horrible hangovers, but when they got up in the air, you know, air above 10,000 feet and went on that pure oxygen, it sobered them right up. But the Falcon is still there today, so my wife and I went over there to have lunch, and Tim and his wife was sitting next to us, and we got to talking, and then found out, you know, we loved the 8th Air Force and the Air War over Europe, and he builds all these bomb sites, and I wrote a book, and so it's nice to get reunited with Tim.
What base in Texas did he become an instructor after he was repatriated?
Actually, he was an instructor at Sebring, Florida, and Lockburn, Ohio.
Okay.
and actually had to crash land a bomber in this a B-17 in the snow at Lockburn. I think maybe my dad didn't fly any after the war, and that might have been one of the reasons. He was shot down once and had to crash land a plane. He goes, "That's enough. I've had enough of enough of the air." But he also had that family, you know, to get back to, you know, being married and have two little girls. So he wanted to get on with his life. Well, thanks a lot for coming. I appreciate it.
Praise the Lord.
Thank you.